first safe drive up.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people, we'll turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom. Thou thy getting get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to get involved in the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live audio at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com. which is the homepage, and catch the live stream at that location. We're streaming live audio at www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and the live stream is playing there also. We're streaming at abitumi.com. That's abitumi.com/timeforanawakening. They stream from Ghana, or you can download the TuneIn Radio app to any of your devices. TuneIn Radio is a free radio app in that TuneIn search engine. Just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if it had the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. It's Time for an Awakening radio program with a fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is also there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with the Abitumi. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Various African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 6:07 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. This Sunday, February the 15th edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening in conversation, activist, organizer, special envoy to Burkina Faso for the Afro-descendant nation, and he wears a lot of other hats too, and I'm going to get him to kind of give a little short bio before we get started with our program this evening. Brother Safiwe Balenka is with us. Geopolitics and related topics will be the topics for discussion while we have Brother Safiwe with us. It'll be good to have him back. He had participated in the 9th Pan-African Congress held in Lomé, Togo, and he'll give us updates on that and a lot of other things tonight. So it'll be a interesting program this evening. If you want to be involved in the discussion or a question or comment, you can dial 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832 with a question or comment. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 6:13 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I know we have some major conversations to bring up and, you know, just some considerations to make. But, I just wanted to open with this thought as we move further into Black History Month. For the American Negro, for the American Blacks, I think as we look over the intellectual historical warfare that Mr. Woodson was involved in that created this Negro History Week, and to give us some opportunity to pause not just to reflect on our cultural achievements, those who've been displaced in what is called the Ma'afa, but to look at our historical experience from the context of warfare so that we can make the appropriate analysis. As we move through, Elliot, we are now having passed the first quarter of the 21st century. And I think it's critical that we mature and grow up in the power dynamics that's going on in the global world as it relates to African people in general and African Americans specifically. And I think in our initial conversation, we'll be touching on some, you know, points of why that's so important and how men and women have given their lives and their life work in order to, you know, make us mature people in a world that really wished to keep us as children in the power relationships of global power that exists right now. And we're sitting in the heart of it as we move through the 21st century. I just thought it was important for me to say that, Ellen.
Richard, before we open up with our guests this evening, I want to relay some sad news to the Time for an Awakening audience. Brother Khalid Rahim, who's been a frequent guest on Time for an Awakening, organizer of the New African Independence Party out of Pittsburgh, the founder and chair, a brother that works, whose work spoke for itself. We lost him, Richard. From what I understand, he had a heart attack on Tuesday, and he basically never recovered, and he passed on Thursday. So once we get some more details of what went on, we can express it to the Time for an Awakening audience. Lost a soldier on the battlefield, Richard, but we just got to pick up that baton and keep moving.
And that's what I'm speaking to, Elliot, because Brother Rahim, you know, gave his life commitment, you know, being a member of the coming out of Philadelphia, being a member of the Panthers. And people make it just like a historical narrative of a moment in time compared to these are men and women again. And Brother Rahim, as you say, one of those soldiers who, you know, continued to put forth the effort for what people take lightly, the freedom and liberation of African people globally and in specifically within the nation, this hellhole of North America, and particularly in the state of Pennsylvania by creating the innovation of a, you know, being a part of that innovation of a political party so that we can be able to govern ourselves from that self-determining principle. Here, once again, is another soldier that we can emulate, you know, who, as we've said on this program, who've done, as you just said, have been doing the work, not done the work, have been doing the work up to that last moment.
Yeah, the last time we saw him, Richard, was in November. I think it was November when the Black Political Conference was here in Philadelphia, right. Organizing conference, and Brother Khalid was there along with Brother Namdi, and it's kind of ironic that I think it was Jamil Alameen's daughter that was there that was talking about them trying to get him. But he has transitioned since then. And now we've lost Brother Khalid. So, again, the struggle continues. I know that he wants that work to continue and be victorious because we're going to be victorious as a people. It's just that it's a setback to lose a brother like that, a hardworking brother. And, again, we'll get more information. I'm quite sure some of the other brothers will call up Brother Namdi and some of the other men and women that were involved in the organization to kind of give us some details. But I just wanted to pass that information along. Richard, continuing on this path that we had been on for quite a few weeks now, getting updates on this geopolitical situation that's changing rapidly, Richard. It's changing rapidly. Mm. But I'm kind of glad that we do have people that have been on this program that are doing the work. They're not sitting back in an armchair and just complaining about what's going on and not doing anything. I guess we're just blessed to be able to be in contact with men and women that are doing the work, and then come back and talk about the work that is being done so people can join in and help them do the work. Our guest this evening is no exception. Activist, organizer, special envoy to Burkina Faso for the Afro-descendant nation, Brother Safiwe Belenka is with us. Brother Safiwe, how are you, sir?
Wow, I just had a moment, just taking a moment to think about our comrade who has joined the ancestors. So at the very moment, I'm just thinking about the meaning of what it is to dedicate one's life to doing this work and then transitioning. I'm good. I'm here in my homeland of Guinea-Bissau. Just grateful for the opportunity to be on your program again.
Well, so if you were ready, last time we talked to you, I think it was before before the 9th Pan-African Congress that was held in Lomé, Togo. You were there. We wanted to get you to give us some updates on some things that was going on. And I think you did a presentation there. You were one of the featured speakers. But before you talk about the Pan-African Congress that was held in Togo, just talk about some of the other work that you're doing beside what I announced on the beginning, because that kind of pales in comparison to some of the other work that you have put in. So just, not to toot your horn, so to speak, because it's not about that, and I know it's not about that for you, but just to let our people know some of the other work that you're involved in before you talk about the Pan-African Congress.
Okay. So the main work that I'm involved in centers on the Afro-descendant right of return, which is the justice, the reparations that are due to our ancestors who were captured and taken as prisoners of the Dum Diversus War, right, that was declared by Pope Nicholas V, June 18, 1452. It's a declaration of war that resulted in what is commonly referred to as the transatlantic slave trade. Over 100 million people died on the continent, and 12 million were taken as prisoners of war and trafficked across the Atlantic and enslaved in the Americas. By virtue of that, under natural law and African law, international law, specifically the Geneva Convention, right? Prisoners of war have the right to be returned to where they came from. And the prisoner of war designation is inherited or is claimed by the descendants of those that were originally taken. So if you were taken and you were enslaved in the land of captivity, and you are still in the land of that captivity, right, and you have not yet been returned to your original homeland, you can still claim that status as a prisoner of war. So most of my work is in using that knowledge and understanding in various international forums like the United Nations, its working group on people and experts, people of African descent, the UN Permanent Forum of People of African Descent, UN forums dealing with a working group of experts on the Durban Declaration, African Union, African Commission on Human and People's Rights. I go into these forums as a ambassador, a diplomat, representing right Afro descendants and championing their right to return, so that on the one hand, African nations recognize their obligations under treaties, specifically the Geneva Convention, to receive us, which means citizenship. It also implies obligations on what are called the detaining powers under the Geneva Convention, those guilty nations, the Holy See of the Vatican, countries like, the Netherlands and Spain and Portugal and France and Britain and the United States, all of those nations that held asiento monopoly war contracts that gave them the exclusive right to wage the war and traffic in the, our ancestors, to bring us into international forums in order to obtain justice. So that is a major part of the work that I've been doing since I joined National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America in the late 1990s. I was at the African Union when they amended their Article 3Q, the Constitutive Act, with this Article 3Q that for the first time included the African diaspora in the governing of the continent. So, and that was in 2003. So I've been in those arenas, lobbying, developing strategy, teaching the law, organizing, trying to collect advisory opinions to go to the International Court of Justice, and basically doing what I can do with my God-given skill set, talent, is to do what I can in these kind of arenas to get justice for our people.
Brother Sifiwe, talk about the Pan-African Congress that was held in Togo. But if you want to, give us a little brief overview of some of the other Pan-African conferences. We all know that the first one was held, put it this way. The first one that I kind of want to recognize is the one that was in 1900 that was convened by Henry Sylvester Williams. But it was one before that. Talk about it. Put them all in perspective. Give us a little brief thumbnail sketch of all of them.
So you're correct. Let's set the table, and then we can go and eat. So the Pan-African Congresses have become known in our, you know, Black history, African history teachings as these events where our best thinkers and strategists and activists come together in sort of a grand event to chart the way forward for our people. The origins of these series of congresses starts at the Chicago Congress on Africa. It was part of the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. You had Africans from the continent come to Chicago to discuss the issues facing African people in the African continent. Now, this was held in Chicago. Now, ironically, our own people, African Americans, right? Afro descendants, new Africans, Black people from America, or in America, living in the land of their captivity, at first were not even allowed to attend that Chicago Congress on Africa. Can you imagine? So the Africans that were there quickly responded by saying, no, that is an injustice. And they fought and organized until finally our kind of contingent was allowed in. And so this was the first time where you had Africans from the continent meeting with those of us that were in the Americas, principally in the Caribbean and the United States, to talk about the grand issues of Africa. That Congress was attended by a lot of AME, African Methodist Episcopal Zion leadership, and you had Bishop Turner and all these people who are talking about, you know, self-determination for Black people, even at that time in 1893. Mm-hmm. So as a result of that, they had a follow-up in Atlanta in 1896, either 1895 or 1896, right around the time of Battle of Adowa. Okay. And this was attended by, again, African Americans. You had Caribbean people there, Africans, but mostly African Americans. And the secretariat for that included Benito Sylvain, who traveled to Ethiopia, met with Emperor Menelik, and this was right after the Battle of Adowa. And so Emperor Menelik, it was suggested to Emperor Menelik that a grand event celebrating Ethiopia's victory over the Italians in the Battle of Attawa in 1896 be celebrated. And so out of those two things, this organizing committee from these two congresses on Africa that happened in Chicago and Atlanta, and this Benito Sylvain diplomat who goes to Ethiopia with Emperor Menelik, they decide in 1900 in London, they would have this Grand Pan-African Congress. And so that's the backstory that started this series of congresses that then get numbered. So that 1900 Congress is considered the first Pan-African Congress, even though it had a prehistory with its roots in my hometown of Chicago. But then after that, you have these Pan-African Congresses. They had another major one in 1919 when you had the Paris Peace Conference, which was the gathering of nations that after World War I that was deciding the world order to come out of that and the establishment of the League of Nations. Ironically, at that time, when you had the Pan-African Congress that was held in Paris, or at that time in conjunction with the Paris Peace Conference, a lot of people don't realize that both W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey, separately, in their various individual capacities, petitioned the Paris Peace Conference that the former German colonies, Germany, you know, lost in World War I. They held territories in Africa as their colonies. And so now at the Paris Peace Conference, they were deciding what was going to be the future destiny of these colonies. Both W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey formally petitioned the United Nations to give those former German colonies in Africa to black people to establish a new African state in Africa. Now, W.E.B. Du Bois' delegation was received at the Paris Peace Conference. They weren't formally, they were received, but they weren't, you know, didn't have a status of nation state or anything like that. Garvey's delegation wasn't received, right? But he still submitted the petition. So just a part of history that a lot of us maybe did not know, but is relevant to the discussion we're going to have tonight. So following from that, you have more Pan-African Congresses. In 1945, you had Manchester, and you had people like Jomo Kenyatta, who is now fighting for independence in Kenya. You had Kwame Nkrumah, right? You had a number of figures who, when they got together at that fifth Pan-African Congress, they made, this is 1945, they made the independence of these territories that were occupied by the colonial settler occupiers. They made liberating these territories from them and granting independence the main objective. And then that happened, right? You get Ghana, you have the Mau Mau Revolution, you have Ghana getting their independence in 1957. And some of the people in the Pan-African Congress go on to become the first president. And the most famous of which, of course, is Kwame Nkrumah. And so then you have the sixth Pan-African Congress that took place in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, under Julius Nyerere. That was 1974. You have the seventh Pan-African Congress that took place in Kampala, Uganda, in 1994. You had various attempts to host the 8th Pan-African Congress in 2014 and 2015. So two different locations, two different organizing committees. One took place in Accra, Ghana. The other took place in South Africa. And then you had this attempt to have what, you know, some people would claim would be the 9th Pan-African Congress. There were attempts made by Dr. Erekana Chihombori-Kwal to host it in Zimbabwe in 2023. I actually served as her coordinator to organize that. At the same time, you had the Global Pan-African Congress attempting to host the 9th Pan-African Congress in Kampala, Uganda, to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the 7th Pan-African Congress that was hosted there. And then you had this emergence of Togo, who had gone through and proposed some agenda items at the African Union that somehow turned into a mandate to host a ninth Pan-African Congress in Lomé, Togo. All of these were scheduled for 2024, and none of them took place. They were all postponed for various reasons. I was working behind the scenes at that time with Eric Onuchi Homborikwa to harmonize the agendas. I was making the argument that having three separately organized Pan-African Congress defeats the very principle of Ubuntu and unity that Pan-Africanism champions, and that three successful Congress would further fractionalize and divide the Pan-African movement, because you have those people that would be supporting, you know, each one of the Congresses. And I said, this actually takes us further away from the Pan-African unity, functional and working unity that we need. And so there was a lot of sort of infighting behind the scenes by various Pan-African leaderships and those that were saying, you know, we can't go here, or you can't go there, or you don't have the right to call this. There was a lot of disunity. It was very disheartening for me personally. But we made the effort, and we realized that one of the principal problems of why we couldn't have one single Pan-African Congress that was supported by the entire Pan-African, all the different factions and things like that, had to do with location. There were people that were saying that you can't have it in Kampala because human rights violations. You had people that were anti-President Museveni and saying there's no way we will attend a Pan-African Congress in Uganda. And you had the same argument, people saying, no, we will not attend the Pan-African Congress hosted in Lomé, Togo, because Togo is, you know, is the, has a track record that is anti-Pan-African and their current human rights violations. So leading up to this Pan-African Congress, Togo was the only one that was sort of still standing and planned and was going to happen. And at that moment, a big controversy, as we got closer and closer to it, the big controversy was that activists in Togo were boycotting and protesting and even outing and shaming Pan-Africanists who were going to attend, saying, you know, it's a contradiction, it's unprincipled. Togo has all of these political prisoners. They had been condemned by ECOWAS for torture, that this was an attempt to hijack the movement from being a Pan-African grassroots movement. It was now being captured by the state and approved by the African Union, which was breaking with the people's tradition of the Congresses. It was state capture of Pan-Africanism. And for all these reasons, it should be boycotted. Nobody should attend. And so at that 11th hour, as I had been for the entire year, I was challenging the Pan-African community to say, look, if we're going to call for a if the resources are there and this thing is going to happen in Lomé, Togo, and we're going to say boycott, it's not enough to just not participate. You have to provide the alternative. So I was challenging these Pan-African veterans and forces that were saying, don't attend, boycott. I was saying, all right, then we have the responsibility of hosting an alternative Pan-African Congress for those legitimate forces. And we were, the Pan-African movement was unable to do that. So I made the argument that regardless of the manner in which the Lomé Pan-African Congress was organized, that since it was going to happen, the best strategy would be for all factions and forces to show up and take over the agenda of the Congress from its organizers. And so I had agreed, I was invited as a keynote speaker in the main forum, and then also to serve as one of the commissioners. There were nine different commissions. And so I accepted the invitation on the principled stance that if those of us, for lack of a better term, you know, credible Pan-Africanists or uncompromising, you know, there was whatever. If we don't show up, and whatever comes out of that is not in the true spirit of Pan-Africanism, it's because we ceded the territory. We surrendered it. And so hosting a Pan-African Congress where you have all of these people from around the world coming requires some sort of state participation, because you have to get visas. You have to have security protocols. It's not like the grassroots can just do it without, you know, working with some government, some state.
Okay.
So I had actually taken a poll among various Pan-African groups all over the planet to find out where, what would be the best location. And the result of that, by a two-thirds majority, was Burkina Faso. People felt like under the, you know, the patronage of President Ibrahim Traoré, that Burkina Faso could be the one legitimate place where we could all meet without it being some kind of contradiction and stuff. So a lot of effort was put into having Burkina Faso host the Congress. And they seriously considered it, but they weren't in a position to make it happen in 2025. And so as a result, Lomé Togo was still there. And so a good number of us decided to go to Lomé Togo and sort of champion the issues and draft resolutions based on, you know, what we felt would be the thing to do. And also to expose the contradiction of having a country that has this deplorable record on human rights of, you know, African people under the African Charter of Human and People's Rights, how they could then pretend to be the patrons and champions of Pan-Africanism, which is supposed to be about the well-being of all African people everywhere. How can you be about the well-being of all African people if even right in your home country you're violating their human rights? And so that was the backdrop leading up to the Ninth Pan-African Congress in Lomé Togo. So let me stop there, and then I can tell you actually what happened. But let me stop there and see if there's any question or discussion or comments about that.
Brother Freeway, the issue of the political prisoner or political prisoners in different African countries, and Togo was one of the ones that was focused on. Who are holding, who is involved in capturing and holding these political prisoners? Because we know that some of the governments on the continent, and that's what the big fight is now, struggling for independence, struggling to break those neocolonial ties. Are some of the political prisoners that have been taken independence fighters? Have they been agents of foreign governments, United States, Europe? Can you give me like a dynamic of these political prisoners?
All right. So that's a great question. And so I raised the issue in my keynote address, and I had focused on Togo, Cameroon, and Guinea-Bissau. So that is what I can speak about, because that is what I have some either knowledge or direct experience about, as well as also, of course, the United States. We have political prisoners, people like Mumia Abu-Jamal, right, in those states.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, from there were over 170 political prisoners in Togo, okay? 35 of which had been on a hunger strike as it approached the Ninth Pan-African Congress. The movement in defense of their human rights, the indigenous Togolese movement for the political prisoners, contacted me about 2 weeks before the Pan-African Congress in Lomé Togo. And they said, Sipiwe, have you seen all this information? Are you aware of these cases? Are you aware of the situation? And if you are, how could you possibly go? We are planning major boycotts, and we want to disrupt it so that it can't even take place. That is what the activists in Togo were trying to do. And they contacted me, and I said, you know, in general, I'm a defender of human rights, so obviously the issue of political prisoners, and I I worked on that issue back at the beginning, you know, when you had the Jericho movement in its early days in America, with international concern, family and friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal and Pam Africa. And I got involved in political prisoner defense and issues in those late 1990s. So these activists in Togo started giving me dossiers and information and all of that. And I told them, I said, all right, look, this thing is going to go on. I know you're planning to boycott it, but those of us who are principled Pan-Africanists, we can be on the inside and we can coordinate so that while you're calling rightfully attention to the issues on the outside, we can be on the inside supporting that. And so I went there with that. So a lot of those political prisoners in Togo, they are activists. They are people that are denouncing the fact that in the last 60 years, 4 million Togolese have migrated because of the poor conditions in Togo.
Okay.
They are the ones that are denouncing the torture that happens in Togo. Now, in Cameroon, I happen to be comrade with a woman who is married to, her husband is Mr. Tchameni, who is part of the opposition in Cameroon, democratic opposition, that was campaigning with their candidate to get an election victory over Biya. And so after Cameroon elections, right, before and during and after, right, these activists, these opposition political figures, whose only crime was, you know, competing to use the democratic process to take control of the state power. That is lawful. That's what political parties do. That's what their reason. And so a lot of the political prisoners in Cameroon, like many other places on the African continent, are merely political opposition to the ruling power.
Okay.
I knew. So when my friend, when her husband was captured and detained, I had firsthand information coming, you know, out of that situation, and I decided to call attention to it. And then I witnessed myself right here in Guinea-Bissau how activists, people denouncing the dictatorial regime of former President Sissoko and the ceremonial coup that happened to prevent the election results from being announced and President-elect Fernando Diaz from being inaugurated, we saw how those people, the President-elect, had to seek refuge in the Nigerian embassy. The main opposition party, who was the former prime minister and head of the National, you know, Popular Assembly, Domingos Pereira, was captured and imprisoned along with other activists. So on the one hand, the answer to your question, I know I took the long route, but I wanted to demonstrate some actual working knowledge. On the one hand, what we're seeing in these countries and elsewhere across Africa is the weaponization, what we call lawfare, that the ruling political party and the ruling powers in these countries take control of the judicial apparatus and or security forces, and then they use that control to target opposition, political opposition, and unlawfully and illegally detain them. Now, are some of these people funded by foreigners? I don't have any direct knowledge, but I would think, well, of course. Any fair student of history knows how governments like the United States fund and infiltrate, right, even create political parties and movements in countries with the intention of destabilizing those countries and creating political instability in other situations that serve their neocolonial geopolitical interests. So I would say, yeah, some of them probably are funded and are agents of that kind of destabilization. But I wouldn't, my defense of political prisoners are for the genuine, you know, activists who are just fighting for better life and better opportunities for their people.
Okay. Before we kind of talk about some of the things, the accomplishments of the Pan-African Congress, because I know that you were involved in some of those things. Richard, did you want to say something before we kind of get into that?
Yeah, I wanted to, and thank you, Brother Sibre, for, again, the work and the demonstration. I think it's important, you know, I want to flush out with you and Elliot and Time for Waking audience some very important pieces that you raised in the opening and the question that Elliot asked about the historical context of the Pan-African Conference, Congress, up to the one that you're going to explore more into. And I think it's important. But the question, I guess the question that came to my mind first, as I honor you for your work, would you consider yourself an ambassador? And we know that, yeah, let me just, not to add to it, to see how, if I'm on or off, because ambassadors are representatives of, usually they consider nation states or a people. Would the work that you're doing, would it be placed in the context of what an ambassador role is, based off of the things that you described presently?
You know, thank you for asking that. That's a very astute question. And so the short answer is yes. Now, let me back that up by saying that as of late, I have been using the title Afro-descendant Theocratic Special Envoy Extraordinary and Reparations Expert. Those words were chosen very carefully to identify what role I am serving in. And let me just say this. When I graduated from high school, and when I went to Yale University, they had this new program called, this new major called Ethics, Politics, and Economics. And it was a major designed to prepare people for having an impact in international diplomatic affairs. Right? I wanted to be a part of that. And through the racism and discrimination of Yale University, when they started that, they limited the class to just 30 white students. Even though I had taken all the prerequisites, gotten great grades and all of these things, right? So I had this calling that I wanted to be involved with law, but on an international level. I say all that to say that then later on, when I left Yale and I started to work in what I call movement work, somehow I came into contact with Dr. Y.N. Cly and Dr. Charles Knox, who had established what was originally called the NCBL, National Conference of Black Lawyers, School of, what was it, NCBL, International Diplomacy and Community Law. It was the first independent black law school. Sometimes I get the full name mixed up, but it was the first and only independent black law school, and they were trying to combine international law with community work. That local is global and global is local. Mm-hmm. All right. And that is where I got my introduction and my first training into what I call New African Diplomacy. Mm-hmm. I had learned from people like Amario Bedelli and Republic of New Africa and all of their work that we were a nation within a nation. Mm-hmm. Even Du Bois is saying this. We were a nation within a nation. And that even though right after emancipation, right, a decision was made by the Lincoln administration, they asked us, what did we want? We responded, they asked us, and their words were, do you want to be colonized, right? Colonized, right, amongst yourself or scattered amongst the whites? And we said, no, we want our own land and territory. So mm-hmm. the United states recognized as an internal domestic colony, their words, at the time of emancipation. Yes. And this is what Republic of New Africa was teaching, is that we were a nation within a nation, and we had the right to self-determination and the right to choose a political destiny, which included establishing the machinery of state government.
Right.
Okay? So when you ask me, am I an ambassador, I recognize that till this day, we are a nation within a nation. We are a captivated or subjugated nation. And it, during 2024, I actually served as Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa. And so in that capacity, when I was in, I actually made interventions at the United Nations, at the African Union, holding that title of Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa. I do not serve in that capacity right now, which is why now I use Afro-descendant. That identifies who we are. That is a legal term that says that these are the people who are whose ancestors were trafficked from their homelands and enslaved in the Americas. So Afro-descendant, theocratic, meaning I wasn't elected by anybody to represent them on the international stage. My capacity to do so is the result of a number of factors that can only come from divine guidance and how divinity works through man to achieve things, right, on earth. And so we are, people are called to do certain things. And so I was called, the fact that I was at the African Union when they amended the Constitution to include African diaspora. The fact that in 2007, I was at the African Union Grand Debate, right, lobbying for our citizenship. That in various moments where at the highest levels, I was present championing our rights, earned me the recognition that here is someone whose mission in life is to represent our collective interests under international law. So that's the theocratic special envoy. So I'm an ambassador or a diplomat, even though we don't have a functioning, recognized state machinery. There's this term, what we call diplomat without portfolio. Mm-hmm. So I represent the nation, even though we don't have, I don't have a government appointment. That is why it's this unique title. So I took the long way to answer that, but I really appreciate the question because it's a legitimate question.
And I mean, it's so important. And I just want to, and you centered the present work that is being done
yes,
appropriately in the historical context. Because when we think about, as you and Elliot raised earlier, that the Pan-African conferences didn't happen in London first. It happened here. And people like, you know, Alexander Walters, Bishop Alexander Walters,
yes,
Bishop McNeil Turner, and others, they had this global view here, thinking of themselves of having international view as it relates to the continent and colonialism, but more important, which I would like us to see, the power dynamics of the people of the world, of the colored people, of the African people of the world who were being colonized domestically and by states on the African states and around the globe colonized. We were here. So I'm saying all that to say that it's important for us to have this historical context of the work that you're doing, because it reinforces that you can operate as a stateless society, which is so yes, interesting, because they can tell you, you know, when they look in the Middle East and they look at all these other, you know, all these other groups that they're supposed to using all this military equipment against, they don't have no problem calling them stateless. But looking for us to look at a formation that is over, you said 1890s, you know, 1880s, 1890s, to 2026 that we've been formulating. You said the Republic of New Africa, and we can go even further back, that we've been operating, putting these place things in place, structures in place, so that you can be in that position and have a technical definition. And we ain't just talking. So I just thought it was important to place this work historically in a structural geopolitical context in a particular warfare that is dealing with state colonialism, domestic colonialism with the people of the world, especially the African people of the world. With that said, let me see if you would agree as you go into the ninth Pan-African. Would you agree with that framing, that conceptual framing?
Absolutely. And we would be remiss to not mention that it was Omowale, Malcolm X, mm-hmm. who implored us to internationalize our struggle. And so internationalizing our struggle meant entering into international law and conceiving of ourselves the way international law conceives us. That was, for a lot of people, that was new. And so, yes, the work that I'm engaged now is directly to try to fulfill those instructions of Omowale and Malcolm X.
And I'll end with this, as you, Ellie, you can go into the next question, that, as you just said, fits into one of the five pillars of reparation, and that's rehabilitation. Yes. You know, for me, because to be an international people, recognize ourselves and operate structurally with discipline and a worldview and a paradigm and a theory, it is so critically important when we have a propaganda machine that says that you're just a bunch of individuals scattered, you know, as you in your narrative earlier, scattered in certain countries, just trying to eke out your individual life with no connection to a liberatory process that is going to bring about your repair, your reparations. I think it's important for us to, in this moment, to really bring that home as you continue to lay out the actual work that you've been engaged in.
Brother Saviwe, talk about some of the accomplishments of the Ninth Pan-African Congress. I know that you championed some of the things there. And in fact, probably one of the things that was very important that some of the activists was pushing for. Talk about some of the accomplishments of that gathering. And it was from what I understand, it was over 1,000 members there from the continent and from the diaspora. Am I right?
Yeah, that's correct. There was high attendance. And so understand one of the things that happened. Well, first, let me start with my keynote presentation, right? There's a personal anecdote. So I was quite anxious and apprehensive about making my keynote address because my conscience was provoking me to address the elephant in the room, Togo's political prisoners and the manner that this thing was organized. And I was also provoked in my conscience because I was the only person from Guinea-Bissau on the program. And we had just witnessed, right, this violation. So how could I go to this Pan-African Congress, give a keynote address, and not, you know, raise these issues? Now, I was worried that if I directly challenge the Togolese government, who is trying to use this as their shining moment, look at us, we're the champions of Pan-Africanism, and I expose them, I didn't know to what extent that might be dangerous. I was warned about this. Likewise, I knew what I had to say about what happened in Guinea-Bissau was also taking a risk personal. And I said as much in my speech. I literally started my talk by invoking the courage of Pan-African heroes. And I said, I'm going to need some of that right now. And then when I got to the issue where I named names and administrations and effectively basically embarrassed and shamed them, exposing them, I then asked the question, will I now become the next political prisoner and target? This was my great fear. I knew very well that I was going to be standing on this huge world platform of Pan-Africanists, and I was going to say the thing that needed to be said that everybody else wasn't going to say. Because people want to, you know, you don't go into somebody's house and then expose them, embarrass them. That's not proper diplomatic protocol. So I was very anxious. And even my new bride was quite concerned about what I was going to say and the effect it might have on my new family. Because these things are real. One of our comrades in Guinea-Bissau was leaving to go to an ECOWAS parliament meeting, and they met him at the airport and detained him. I was worried that they were going to be waiting for me at the airport on my way to the, right? Or when, after I finished, that they would be waiting for me on my return. I was quite worried about that. And so in that moment, you know, you have to, all of our great heroes and sharers, not like they never felt fear or anxiety. It's that they decided that they were going to stand up and risk everything and not be silent and say or do the thing that needed to be done in spite of the fear, in spite of the risks. Wow. That is what being a revolutionary is all about.
Okay.
So I had challenged Togo in my speech to, all right, since you have called this Congress and I have now exposed you, here is your path towards redemption. You lead a campaign for general amnesty. If you do that, it will lead you towards this path of redemption. And so I gave that speech on December 9th. On December 30th, right, the president of Togo made a speech and promised to deliver an amnesty, which he did the following day. So to start January 1st of this year, he released 1,511 prisoners, including 70 of the approximately 150 political prisoners. So right after what for me, one of the greatest accomplishments of the Ninth Pan-African Congress is that these prisoners and these 70 political prisoners were freed and were able to join their families. That's a tangible result. And I wrote a letter of not congratulations, but I commended, right, the president of Togo for keeping his word and doing that. Now he needs to go further and do more. So that is one of the tangible things that came out. Another tangible thing is two of the three people that I named in Guinea-Bissau have also been freed. So that's one of the things that came out. Now, to be quite honest, I was very disappointed and critical of actually the overall conduct of the Congress and what was done. I was named to Commission 6, and the theme of Commission 6 was the fight against racism and the effective implementation of the Durban Declaration. And then I was named rapporteur for that commission. It was chaired by Nandi Pandor of South Africa, the esteemed official from South Africa. As reporter, it was my job to collect the work of our commission and then put it into a report that is to be submitted to the organizing committee for part of the final resolutions. I kid you not. At the last minute, at the end of the commission, officials from the Togolese government came in with the Commission 6 draft resolution. They had already written the resolution, and they only gave it to us at 3:30 p.m. when we were scheduled at 4 p.m. to reconvene in the main plenary and present our draft resolution. So we didn't actually, you know, when you think of a commission and you think of the work, you think, okay, all these people are going to gather. They're going to sit down. They're going to be given an opportunity to make recommendations. What should be in the resolution? What should be the language? Blah, blah, blah. And then we somehow, in that short amount of time, put it all together and say, this is what we are drafting as recommendations or resolutions from this commission. That is not what happened. They literally gave us the script that they wanted, and our commission protested. And then I started talking to the other commissioners to find out that is basically what happened. So most of the commissioners were not happy with that process and even insulted and felt that we were being used, which was the very criticism of a lot of the veteran Pan-Africanists who were saying that this was the elite state capture, that this Pan-African Congress was being organized to serve the agenda of the Togolese state and the African Union, and was not serving the agenda of the legitimate Pan-African grassroots movements. And so the manner that this thing came up, you know, was being conducted gave credence to that. So to this day, I have yet to see the final resolution as produced by the commissioners themselves. I don't even think that exists. I saw a general kind of resolution that came out as a kind of preliminary summing up of what happened, but that wasn't written by us. That was written by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Togolese government. So I can't say, other than whenever you have a gathering of this amount of people coming from all over, there's a certain amount of networking that goes on, that builds alliances, builds recognition, agendas, strategies. All of that is good, unofficial, you know, developments that come out of it. But in terms of anything significant coming out of the Ninth Pan-African Congress beyond the release of the political prisoners, I don't see any.
Let me throw this in there and get your feelings. Oh, Richard, you want to say
something? No, go ahead.
Let me throw this in, Brother Sophia, and get your feelings on it, because it's 54 countries on the continent of Africa, and we see what's going on there in some of the countries where the young population there are developing leadership to fight against this neocolonial state that the continent has been in for hundreds of years. So when we see the 54 countries getting together, we know it's countries like Burkina Faso and Mali, and there's other countries that have been co-opted. So it's a struggle there. It's an internal struggle. Even though some of them might seem as though that they're for independence of Africa. They might be for independence of Africa with some type of Western influence. And that's not what I'm trying to say is this, because you mentioned about the conference being held in areas, but you still had to have a political connection. Did I get that right, Brother Sifiwe? When the politics has to be involved in order to have it in certain countries. This is what I really want to frame it, because for the work you're doing now on the continent, you started here. You were here. You were born in Chicago, like you said, but you've repatriated and you've become a citizen of Guinea-Bissau. In order for our people here in the United States, in this diaspora, which is some of the most powerful blacks that have been scattered outside of the continent, are here. How necessary is it, or is it a hindrance, that we don't have a strong political voice to go along with the will of some of the people here? Is that a hindrance, a large hindrance, or our people can still win? Personally, I believe our people can still win without the strong political voice. But how do you feel in reference to not seeing a strong political voice coming out of this country, similar to what you're seeing on the continent? Because it's a struggle there. You just described an internal struggle that's going on. How do you feel about, because you were here, you were here, your family was here, and you see what's going on here politically with quote-unquote black leadership. How does that hinder the people's struggle when you see what's going on with black leadership here?
I would say that there's lots of strong political voices that are speaking at the local level, the state level, the national level, and even the international level. What we don't have is strong, centralized institution that can speak on behalf of the collective, the nation within the nation, at the international level. For example, I speak in these forums as Afro-descendant theocratic special envoy extraordinaire, but I don't have the machinery of an institution geared at supporting the kind of work that I do at the international level that can mobilize the 28 million African Americans of voting age. Okay? So we have lots of people, highly intelligent, highly articulate, that are doing great work in articulating, demanding, teaching. They are voices. But for example, the African Union does not take us, the AU 6th region, seriously the way it does the other five regions of the African Union, because they don't see anyone with the capacity to significantly mobilize the African diaspora, the 6th region, which is 250 million people. So we have voices in these forums, but those voices are not connected to institutions that can actually mobilize. So let me give a quick example. In Ethiopia, to build that great hydroelectric dam, when the IMF and World Bank failed to give them the loans, the Ethiopian state mobilized its own citizens to finance that brilliant project. Who amongst us can give an instruction to black people in America to achieve a specific measurable political outcome, and the people will actually follow those instructions and achieve it? We don't have that. This is what Marcus Garvey was trying to do with his UNIA and 11 million people. This is exactly what Malcolm X was trying to do by with John Henry Clark, who you used to open the show, both of them. The goal was to create the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which had that kind of power. Then we could be respected. Then when you have a John Henry Clark, or you have a Malcolm X, or you have a Queen Mother Audley Moore, or you have any number of people like Kim Poole, who's on this call, or myself, who are going into these international forums, right, and who are speaking on behalf of us, it's backed up by if we don't take these people seriously, they can mobilize people to what? Boycott, have a tourist boycott. We will not come and visit your country. We will not invest in your country. We can do positive mobilization. All right, we're going to collect $50 million by getting 50 million of us to give $1 each and put it into a fund that can be used, right, to bring water to a community or whatever. They know that we haven't reached that level of organized and centralized, as the Rastafari community always says, organize and centralize, come as one, right? So my answer to your question is, we are suffering in the international arena, not because we don't have voices. It's because those voices are not backed up by power, which comes from the strength of unity, functional, practical unity, institutionalized. That is our weakness.
Oh, boy. Mm-hmm. You know, before I take a break, let me see if... we got a couple callers that's been on hold since you've been on. Let me see if I can go to a couple of them. Let's go to Baltimore, Maryland first. Baltimore, are you there?
I mean, I can always represent Baltimore. I didn't plan on saying anything tonight. My name is Kim Poole.
Mm-hmm.
I'm with the Teaching Artists Institute. It's always a pleasure to hear our brother Baba Sifwe. Certainly a Baba in this work, my brother, because he's still a young man, though he started so young. It was a pleasure to hear him speak to the names of the people that were liberated from those prison cells after participating in the Ninth Pan-African Congress. A delegation from the Teaching Artists Institute was also present in Lomé. And I want to shout out and hold up Basile Amin Nuvivi. He's a journalist that started as a student activist at the university in Lomé that had been beaten and tortured because he continues to write the truth. And so I appreciate all of our storytellers and the griots that educate our children, that engage the masses. And as someone that is an artivist doing work in 9 countries, 7 of which are on the continent of Africa, I just want to say it's important for us to work grassroots and grass tops. We call that glocal. Yes, working in the grassroots is where we get our strength. You are the legs. But if we aren't able to scale that vision and have influence in international bodies that govern the days of our lives, all is for naught. And so, again, I didn't plan to speak. If you happen to be in Baltimore, though, please check out A Part of the Solution. Our exhibition right now at Trinity Baptist Church is there, and it speaks to the Ukumbushu approach, which is a method for interfaith, reparatory justice, and healing that began last year at the Vatican during African Liberation Week. You heard Brother Sifwe speak earlier about the Dumb Diverses. A lot of our work comes out of his study. We are the practice. We speak to what happens next after we've identified the violation, after we understand historically the violation. Now, how do we begin the atonement holistically? We want to be a part of that solution. And so we're always looking for folks. We're still old enough to be on Facebook. So find us on Facebook, facebook.com/teachingartist, one word. And know that whenever Brother Sifwe is speaking on any platform, we support him wholeheartedly as an artivist and ambassador of global Africa. Thank you again.
Thank you, sister, for your contribution. You know, before we go to Toronto, stay with us. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll go straight to your call, Toronto, and then we'll continue the conversation. You can get involved, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. Abibitumi.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. Abibitumi.store is here for you. Abibitumi, Black Power, Abibitumi. The only word you need to know to join your global Kometsu Black family, to join your interconnected Kometsu Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
It does not profit black people or poor people anything to have the vote and not be able to select the candidates who they want to choose. Now, how can you choose between Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, Agnew, Wallace, and Humphrey? There is no choice. Evil is evil. There's nothing in between that. I think the vote can only be used as a tool of organization. We can only use the vote to organize our people. Now, to really believe that we can put someone in office and that these people would be responsive to our needs is naive, politically naive. Because even if one of the black candidates who ran for office was to take the office of president, then black people must be prepared to fight against that person. Why? Because, you see, the system mandates the action of the individual. The individual does not determine how this country will function. This country works off the military-industrial complex, which means that it's profitable to wage war. And unless you, you know, devise another plan, another scheme to sustain, to boost this economy, then it's going to be necessary to wage war. Whether, you know, a black individual is in office or a white individual is in office. Well, we're talking about a complete a change in system.
The system is rotten to the core. That's why every time we have had a presidential election, whether it's white or black, you always have to choose between the lesser of two evils. So you either vote for Satan or the devil, and you catch hell with either one.
This included comedians, comics, trumpet players, baseball players. Show me in the white community where a comedian is a white leader. Show me in the white community where a singer is a white leader, or a dancer or a trumpet player is a white leader. These aren't leaders. These are puppets and clowns that have been set up over the white community and over the black community by the white community and have been made celebrities and usually say exactly what they know that the white man wants to hear.
One black man believes in violence, one believe in integration, one believe that one day after we all marry white women, we'll all be a light brown color and there'll be no problem. One believes that if we get enough politics and education, we can take over the country and be the mayor and the president. One believe, such as I, that separating on some land will solve it. Cleaning up our own neighborhoods, respecting our own women, and doing something for ourselves and quit begging white people. This is our solution.
You know, we really are being colonized. In a colony, the education is controlled from outside. The politics is controlled from outside. The economics is controlled from outside. The police in a colony are not there to serve and to protect, but there to keep the colonized ones from disturbing the status quo. The question is, do we want to continue to live as a colony, or do we want to be like the original 13 colonies and decide that we've had enough? Let's break from a colonial past and let's seek freedom.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 7:31 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening in conversation, activist, organizer, special envoy to Burkina Faso for the Afro-descendant nation, Brother Sifiwe Belenka is with us. We're talking about the 9th Pan-African Congress that was held in Lomé, Togo from December the 8th to the 12th, along with other geopolitical issues. If you want to get involved in the conversation, you can dial 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Let's go straight to Toronto. Toronto, are you there?
Yes, sir. How are you? How's everyone doing?
Good, good, good.
Oh, I wanted to ask a question to Richard and everybody on the panel. You know, David Walker had an appeal, which was called the David Walker's Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World, which was published in 1829. And he talked about the liberation of Africans inside the United States and around the world. I think that was, kind of going against the whole so-called FBA folks that talk this tribalism stuff about only dealing with the black people in America, who some of them claim we're really Native Americans or Indians. I like to have the panel answer that question if possible.
Well, you know, do me a favor, again, state that question, because I want to have Brother Sifiwe kind of understand. Did you understand him, Brother Sifiwe, the question?
I kind of understood it, but if he can restate it kind of directly, what exactly is the question? That would be helpful.
Okay, the question is, we as a people, Africans in the United States are a nation within a nation, but we have never, part of our leadership has always held the position that we were, had the right to self-determination, inside the United States. However, we should work with African people all over the world.
Okay, so again, I agree with you. Made a statement. You didn't ask a question. You made a statement, right? So I'm still not. What you said, I agree with. Yes.
Oh, the question of I'm saying, the FBA folks are saying that we should not unite with the other Africans around the world, and I'm saying that what I understood Richard was saying, he was making an argument that we should unite with all the Africans around the world. However, we have a right to be independent as black people inside the United States, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. All right. So, again, you still didn't form it in the phrase of a question, but...
Let's do that as a way, or the way I want to... If you don't mind, brother, from...
Yeah, go ahead.
And brother, Seabay, to... Because something that was raised when you were talking about the ninth conference and the whole thing of the sixth region. And, you know, David Walker spoke in the context of us, you know, having that international view, but you raised the point of the structure that we don't have, the power structure that we don't have. And it made me, you know, so and it made me ask the question based off of this experience up to this point, what is it that we need to do, and we're doing a lot of things to put it, but what would be the thing that you see would be necessary to implement us in the diaspora to be able to be more recognized, be more organized around this structure, this six region structure? Have there been any thoughts to that would reinforce our international participation, give us a global structure, and give us sound footing in relationship to the African Union and how these African nation states view the sixth region? What is it that, what's your assessment that is necessary?
So, remember at the Million Man March, when Louis Farrakhan said, wait a minute, I want everybody to reach into your pocket, take out $1 and put it in the baskets that are circulating. And we witnessed raising $1 million in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. What is needed is an entity, a structure, an institution with a leadership of such stature and credibility that they can issue the instruction. We want every single adult male and female in the sixth region to donate $1 right now, for example, through the Abibi Toomey platform, right? Send $1 right now, and 50 million of us will do it. When we reach that level, we will be a force to be reckoned with. Technically speaking, that should be easy to do. Unlike during Garvey's time, we have the technology and the communications tool to actually reach those 50 million people instantaneously on any given hour and any given day. And we have the ability to collect $1 from every person, regardless of where they live. This can be done in real time. But we have yet to demonstrate that we can do it. To me, that is the standard. When we are able to do that, and then that $50 million that is raised just like that can be deployed to, for example, you know, whatever development project is the priority at the moment, whatever emergency relief is the priority at the moment, even funding, take someone like me. He asked, am I an ambassador? unlike my counterparts that have state portfolios, they collect revenue taxes that finance the traveling from this meeting in this country to that meeting to this meeting with a staff mm-hmm. to produce. I don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't even fund properly our international campaigns. So I would say that's a practical answer of what is needed.
Let me say something and throw something in there, too. In reference to the, I guess the question that Toronto asked when he was trying to frame it around some of these new philosophies. You know, Toronto, you mentioned in the beginning David Walker and his appeal to color citizens of the world. Brother Safiwe gave a synopsis of the Pan-African Congresses. And some of them were called, like the one in 1900, was called by Henry Sylvester Williams, who was from Trinidad, if I'm not mistaken.
Trinidad, right.
So it's always been, Dr. King went to Kwame Nkrumah, Ghana, when he was inaugurated as the leader there. Malcolm talked
about it. Louis Armstrong was even in Ghana even before Satchmo. Satchmo was there even before Dr. King.
But what I'm trying to say is, any of our people that have been doing the work understand that we need to unify. Our enemies know that too. That's why they want to keep us from doing it by any means necessary, as far as they're concerned. So you see all these type of new philosophies come up that's not based on anything. This thing about I'm just from here. I'm a slave. I'm not related to any of these. You're talking about these foreigners, this and that. This is not based on anything. So I try not to even feed into it because it makes no sense to me. And if you compare it with history, you kind of see where these type of movements have been coming from. I'm not talking about everybody that believes that philosophy because some of our people don't know. But I'm talking about the embryo, the thought of this type of thing getting legs is not coming from anybody in our community. These things have been planted there, and some of our people latch onto it because we've been void of history for so long.
I agree completely.
Okay, I just wanted to mention that in reference to what you said.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you, sir, for your contribution.
You're welcome, sir.
Right. Brother Safiwe, let me kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about before I talk about the right to return, things of DNA and things that you've been working on, let me talk about things of resistance, because we're looking at, to me, we exist here. I mean, you ain't getting beside now, but you still have family here. Me and Richard are here. We exist here in what I consider the belly of the beast. This stuff that the United States and Western governments, and being the United States is kind of the head of the West, this stuff that the United States and their partner in the Middle East, Israel, are doing is totally against international law, and the things that they're doing, it really is beyond the pale almost. They've been doing it all along, but this new administration, however you want to put it, are doing things right in your face when before they would do this type of stuff and keep it undercover because they didn't want to be exposed like this. Well, this administration is just doing it right out. They don't care whether it's known or not. So in your estimation, what can black folks do here to resist this? Resistance first comes from the mind before any physical thing manifest. And when I say physical, I'm not talking about necessarily anybody going out busting windows, hitting somebody in the head, or taking some type of aggression against anybody. I'm talking about physical things as far as what we must do as a people to organize or to do other things. What do you see as far as a resistance for our people to start doing now?
Wow. That's a very fundamental, it's a great question. And so I'm trying to figure out where to really start this. You're right. All behavior is the end result of processes that involve thought and values. Our values determine what information we allow into our systems, right? And then if it's something that we highly value, we act on it. Right? Our values determine what information we allow into our system, but we deprioritize it, we put it on the shelf, and we don't act on it. And then our values determine what information we reject. We don't even allow it into our system. And then it's thought which produces our behavior. So if we want behavior that resists the forces that are hurting us, that are against us, if you will, we want behavior that resists that, it starts with having thoughts that resist, right, accepting the injustice. And those thoughts can only be produced by a value system that is able to discern what is right or what is just from what is not right and unjust. So Pan-Africanism has been purported to be the system of values from which produce concepts, ideas that will lead to behaviors that perform all the various resistance. That can be in the form of building institutions that teach us the concepts that cause our thinking to resist the oppression and injustice against us, right? It can be, it take various forms, including, right, the use of physical force. When physical force is used against us in an unjust way, we are entirely entitled to use physical force to resist that. And leaders like Malcolm and Revolutionary Action Movement were very clear about that, right? And it doesn't mean you have to go around with rhetoric and propaganda directly aimed toward that. But we have to be realistic, right? Force is being used to violate you. You stop that force with sufficient counterforce. So the resistance that has to happen is getting people's awareness to that level. How do we develop sufficient counterforce to stand up to the bullies, right? You led up this comment by, and it came up earlier in the conversation about, we are living in this era right now where we are witnessing the collapse of an international legal order, an international moral order, where the rule of law has collapsed. And now we have returned to a feudal order where might makes right. And this is critically important because we live in an era where we also have the capacity for mass destruction, weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons. And so when you see Israel committing genocide in Gaza against the Palestinians, and you have the International Court of Justice render an advisory opinion saying they are in violation of international law, right, committing genocide, They must take the following actions to stop it, and they owe reparations to Palestine. And almost the entire, every nation on earth, almost every single nation, right, agreed with this, the advisory opinion and the actions that needed to be taken. And yet, the world has not been able to provide sufficient counterforce to force Israel to stop and to pay reparations. So Israel continues to act with impunity. We also see, for example, when the United States went into Venezuela and against all principles of international relations and international law, took Maduro, and that was condemned by nearly all nations around. Nobody, the world order has not produced sufficient counterforce to punish the United States for doing that and to prevent it from doing other things. So this is the evidence that we are in this might makes right era. And it's not just the big nations, it's the small nations. Right here in Guinea-Bissau, there was a free and fair election. The people's will spoke. They voted for this candidate. And people, a small group of people with the power to take control of the state apparatus, did so in an illegal, unconstitutional manner. And there has been no internal response strong enough to stop them and to regain control. So all across the world, we're witnessing the collapse of the system that, for example, Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie, when he spoke in his historic speech to the United Nations, said, right, it's the principle of collective security. And if that structure collapses this time around, it's not just small nations being invaded by stronger aggressor nations. It's the fate of humanity itself. So where is this going? The way you stop a bully is by stopping him. Right now, Israel and the United States is showing that they put their hands up. You know, who's strong enough to stop us? And so far, the world is impotent. But there is one thing that can stand up to the military might of Israel and the United States. You know what that is? That's nuclear weapons. So in the same way that the United States calculated that we have to drop this bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to end this World War II, and they did that, we're escalating, we're getting to the point where eventually one of the nuclear powers is going to be so provoked and realize that the only way to stop the international bullies who are operating on might makes right with impunity is to launch a nuclear missile against them. Now, when that happens, the United States will have about 12 and a half minutes to decide whether or not it is going to take on a Christ consciousness and sacrifice itself for the sake of humanity by not launching a retaliatory strike, or whether it's going to be to hell with them. They launch a strike against us, they're going to unleash nuclear missiles, and there you go. They're going to have about 12 minutes to decide that. Now, the question is, when that happens, and we know the United States is not going to sacrifice, allow that one nuclear missile to come and kill 2 to 3 million people. The United States is not going to allow that to happen because they have a divine consciousness that realizes that if they take their programmed response, it will lead to the destruction of humanity. They won't sacrifice that. So they're going to launch their retaliatory strike. When these things happen, the question is where do you want to be? The United States is going to be the target. I'm speaking to my people right now. Whether you like it or not, you are a subjugated minority nation within the military power of the United States in this white supremacy era. You are outnumbered. At best, you are 20% of the population. You are outnumbered. Okay? You cannot use the political machinery to get what you want without compromise, because you're outnumbered. So in such a situation, sober analysis would say, leave. This is the meaning, for example, for all of those people listening right now who are Christians, when you read in Revelation 18, right? When the whore of Babylon, the great merchants of the earth, when you see their judgment come in 1 hour, and she shall be utterly burned by fire, and when you see the smoke of her burning, that is when it says, come out of her, my people, that you partake not of her sins, neither of her judgments which are to come. So the great merchants of the earth, what are we talking about? September 11, 2001, it was the World Trade Center, literally the headquarters of World Trade by name. She shall be utterly burned by fire. The official explanation for why those World Trade Center was destroyed was that the heat and the fire that melted the support beams caused the buildings to collapse on itself. When you see the smoke of her burning, which person in the world did not see a picture of when that first plane hit and the smoke was coming from the towers? That was circulated around the world. Everybody saw it. So when these things happen, that is the sign. Come out of her. Guess what, all you FBA people? Guess what, right? This land belonged to the Potawatomi, the Sioux, the Cherokee, the Iroquois Confederation. It's their land, not yours. It is not the Anglo-Saxon settler colonialists who claim it as their own through a distortion of the narrative history, where they got it by what? Conquest, might makes right, and deception, making treaties and then, you know, lying about them and not holding them. The truth of the matter is, at emancipation, we found ourselves to be a new class of beings. We were emancipated, free people whose status had never been contemplated in American law. So between the emancipation and the 14th Amendment is 2.5, almost 3 years. We were a free people. That means we had the right to decide our political destiny. And it really boils down, it was four choices back then, and it's four choices today. Choice number one, return to where you came from. That's repatriation. Choice number two, right? Establish an independent state of your own on territory you currently occupy. The Lincoln administration recognized this and set aside land in the South Carolinas, in the Carolinas, right? And also set aside land in Davis Bend, Mississippi, that were, in their words, right, self-governing colonies that would be assisted until they reached full political maturity, which was independence. The United States recognized that. So you can either go back to where you come from, develop a state of your own, right? Integrate into the American system, integration. That is what was forcibly forced indoctrination pushed on us, or emigrate to some third party country. Those are the same choices you have today. The question is, which one are you consciously making? And a lot of people are staying in America, trying to integrate, trying to make that work. And so when this escalation comes, you are going to participate in that. And it's not your country because you don't control it. You're only 20% of the population. So if you choose that option, just understand what you're going to be facing. If you choose the option, as Republic of New Africa did on March 31st, 1968, understand you're going to face the full retaliation of what? First, which came COINTELPRO, and then came National Security Memorandum 46, which what? Targeted the growing black nationalist consciousness. Newsweek did a poll in 1969. 30% of black youth in America wanted a nation of their own and believed it would take violence to get it. 30%. Black nationalism was rapidly spreading. And that is why they came with COINTELPRO and National Security Council Memorandum 46. And then they lied and they said, we couldn't just go after black people and say it's because we want to go after black people. So they created the war on drugs, which was an excuse to what? Wage war against black people in their communities. So if you are going to struggle for the exercise of self-determination and to get territory in the United States that could understand you will be facing the same military might that the rest of the world is facing. And how you think you're going to win that, you will have to decide that. So then the options that are left are leaving. Now, you can either leave and you can go to someplace like Honduras or Panama or Denmark or Russia or whatever, where you will be what? Foreign refugees. Or you can choose to go back to where you have your birthright, your right of return, where you have ancestral ties. It is your birthright, which is the African continent. Everyone is making that choice right now at this moment, consciously or unconsciously. Your inaction, if you just stay there and do nothing, that's a choice in and of itself. And this might lead then to having the discussion on the right of return. But that's how I see it. And I know that's not, it's uncomfortable and it's unpopular. You've got these people who say, well, our ancestors, we built this country, so we have a right to it. Yes, you do. I agree with that. But your right is inferior to the claim of the original inhabitants of the land. It's superior to the United States government claim. But as we can see, you cannot count on the international community, even if you were to win a case at the ICJ, like the Palestinians in Gaza, there's no international collective moral force that will enforce your right. So if we're in might makes right and unity is strength, where is the most group of people that you share ancestral ties with? They're in Africa. Where are all the resources? They're in Africa. Your best chance is to join and unite and make Africa strong enough to defend itself. Let me land there.
let me say this before I transition over to the right of return conversation. And I'm going to say this, and I'm going to pass it to Richard just in case he wants to weigh in. I can't disagree with anything that you've just said the past 10 minutes, Brother Safiwe. And you, I like the fact that you use a scriptural reference or Bible reference to, because most of our people here in the United States are Christian. Mm-hmm. And when you use that reference about come out from among her, be not partakers of her sins. You know, see, those are things that's not necessarily taught in the church. The sins of this country is obvious. The sins of these people that propagate white supremacy is obvious. So it has to start somewhere. It has to start in the mind before it can translate into movements of any body form. Some of the things that we do here to help bolster this country, because their God is money. We can start by stopping the behavior of, I'll give an example. You just had a quote unquote holiday that just passed with a little half naked white guy shooting people with bow and arrow and call it Valentine's Day. You got one coming up in about another month with eggs, a rabbit laying eggs. And they somehow tie that in with some righteousness from the Bible. We need to stop participating in these European holidays. That would be an outward sign that our people of resistance is stop participating in these holidays. We see that they done cut the legs out from under black people. 300,000 people have lost government jobs, and of the 300,000, 271,000 is black. They cut out affirmative action where they don't want, sure, that might not affect Richard or maybe somebody older, but it's going to affect your children where they won't be able to obtain the so-called job that you had. They won't be able to get it. They're cutting the legs out from under our people right while we see this. We have to do something about it. We have to do something. We just can't stand and watch. This is not a tennis match. Stop celebrating these holidays. Stop. that would be an outward sign of resistance right away. Now, I might be preaching to the choir, or I might be just hollering on deaf ears. I don't know. But that's one of the ways that we could start right off the bat. Richard?
Yeah, and I agree with you in that sense. And Brother Sifwe, did what you laid as far as those four choices. And it's just interesting that the clarity that you brought those four choices up, we don't really have the different groupings, and I'm just speaking of the opportunities that we have to speak about these different positions, because within the whatever the amount of people we have, there are those of us that are taking these different positions. And in one case, I feel some of them, or at least two of the four people, are not being honest. The thought pattern is not being honest about that's the choice that we're taking. One, that we're going to stay here. Two, that we're in alignment with might makes right, you know. And three, that we recognize who has the might and that they don't like us, even though we're making this choice. It seems that in our discussion, that one of the four is not being honest about that. But the other, in relationship to the Pan-African, I want to go back to get clarity, or if you can add more to it, when you were talking about, and I appreciate your honesty, of the formation of the conference through the nation states and the excuses that they had. But I'd like to get more clarity of what nation states that were talking about the conference, the Ninth Pan-African Conference, that you've seen did take the principal stand. You brought up about Burkina Faso and how everybody in the diaspora seen that would have been the place to go. But is there other nations in that back and forth of where we should host this, nation states that we should become conscious and aware of, if for those who are looking at places to go or looking at the political dynamics, if I'm making myself clear, what states were in agreement about hosting but didn't have the power to make it happen, if that makes sense?
There were none.
Oh. Yeah.
There were, first of all, the Ninth Pan-African Congress, you did not see, except for maybe one, the president of Togo himself, there were no heads of states in attendance in giving addresses. There was approximately maybe 7 to 9, there was just a small handful of ministers of foreign affairs. So even the African states themselves did not support through, you know, significant participation in the Ninth Pan-African Congress. Now, I have to take that back. There was a plan to try to bring a Congress to Kinshasa in the Congo.
Hmm.
And when M23 rebels were getting close, that was abandoned. The poll that we took after Burkina Faso, which was the overwhelming favorite, the next two were Accra and Addis Ababa. But no formal overtures for them to hold the Congress were made. And, you know, so none of these states were really strong. No, they weren't bidding on hosting the Pan-African Congress like you would bid on hosting the Olympics. Like, you know, usually it's a competition to hold such a grand, prestigious event. That's not what was happening on the African continent.
And for those of us who, for those of us who are looking at, I mean, because this is real politics when we're what you're raising. And I think that's important for us if we're going to be really mature about the geopolitical reality. So I'm really thankful that, you know, there is no romanticism in your direct experience and the feedback that you're giving, because this is power politics. And we who, even if for those of us who are looking at repatriation, we have to be centered in the real politics that we are engaging in. What is it that you mentioned earlier about as a solution, you know, us being able to, you know, finance create a structure and finance the structure or those ambassadors who are doing the work in relationship to these states to make this to those nation state leaders or that class of bureaucrats? What is it that we have to do, those who are looking towards repatriation, looking towards the unification of the continent as a real strategic vision? What is it that you see we have to do based off of this particular experience?
So what needs to be done that will catapult us into a level of seriousness and consideration is to conduct a plebiscite.
Mm.
A plebiscite for self-determination. As I already said, it has all, from the first ancestor that was captured and disembarked, there was always four choices, right? Fight back and somehow get back to where they were taken from. Escape to liberated territory where they found themselves, right? Try to integrate into the society, which was very difficult. Even, you know, you couldn't do it as a slave, and if you were a free person, you couldn't really integrate, right? Or find some other territory to escape to, like Canada or Panama or something. All right. So the thing that needs to be done is to once and for all give every single 29 million African Americans of voting age the opportunity to say which one of the four choices they want. If we were to do that with at least 80 to 85% participation, that would show the international community conclusively, right, that African American people or Afro descendants in the United States understand at some level the international political process for exercising self-determination. The first thing you have to do is you have to give a credible demonstration of what it is that the people want. And it's not, as Mario Bedelli taught us, it's not an all or nothing or a winner take all. Self-determination means literally you yourself get to determine which one of those four things is best for you. You may decide that the best choice for you is to stay and try to integrate in America. What you want is the power to be able to do that and be get your full rights respected. You may make the choice that establishing a nation state of your own, say, for example, in the Black Belt territory of the United States, where we have historically and predominantly had the majority of our people living, and we have heritage claim to that territory, that is best for you and your family. You may decide, as I have, no, best thing is repatriate to my ancestral homeland. But what we need is to demonstrate a unity. And it's the principle of self-determination which brings all four of those different agendas and choices together. What we want is each one of us wants the power to decide and effectuate our choice. So I want for my brother what I want for myself. I want to be able to decide this is what's best, and then I want the resources to be able to do it. The resources is what we call reparations. So what we can, it doesn't matter if you want to stay and integrate into America, your common ground with the person who wants to repatriate is you both want the right to choose and the power to implement. Mm-hmm. That's what organizing and conducting a plebiscite does. Now we don't have to fight each other.
Yes.
Oh, staying in America versus black nationalism versus repatriation. Now we don't have to fight each other. We all unify for let us conduct the plebiscite so that we can inform the international community. We have 11 million people that want option one. We have 6 million people that want option two. We have 22 million that want option three, and we have 1 million that want option four, whatever that is. Now you can inform the international community, which is required and obligated to respect your right to self-determination. Now you're able to go to the African Union and say, here's the results. Let's say 6 million people out of 50 million people, 6 million want to repatriate to Africa. Now that puts pressure on these governments to prepare for that. And if they don't, they are in violation of their obligations under the Geneva Convention. On top of that, we now have the miracle of DNA testing, right? And one of the accomplishments that came out of 2025, I got the African Commission on Human and People's Rights to say that under the African Charter of Human and People's Rights, right, that the states are obligated to facilitate DNA, voluntary DNA testing, so that we can overcome ethnocide, know who we come from in Africa so that we can exercise our right of return. This, the African Commission on Human and People's Rights said that this is a matter under the African Charter and states are obligated to facilitate that. So if you can demonstrate, all right, we did a plebiscite in the United States, this many people want to repatriate, now the African Union and it's 54, 55 member states now have to begin to prepare for receiving. That involves citizenships. That involves planning for resettlement, reorientation. That's going to put pressure on them to say, we need the reparations to be able to properly manage this. These people that come, they're going to need hospitals and housing and all of these things. Where are the resources going to come for that? That's what the reparations are for. And reparations are also for the people who want to integrate into America, but they don't want to remain at the bottom of American society because of poverty and living in neighborhoods that don't have the fresh food and the hospitals and all the services. So the number one thing is to get everybody on this page to say whatever it is that you want, the pathway towards getting it and getting the support from the international community is taking the first step in conducting a plebiscite.
I don't know if I'm going off, but I have to ask you, Elliot, is it okay? Because Brother Sikwe, y'all have pushed me into the area, which I'm glad, and you've done work in this area. And I just wanted to make the time for the awakening audience to know, when you say about a plebiscite, it's not like some people haven't been working. The Afro-descendant community has been organizing, and a plebiscite ballot had been created. Is that correct?
So it is correct that Afro-descendant Nation had been promoting the plebiscite, and I was intimately involved in that. The ballot that you speak of, though, unfortunately, technically, did not qualify or was not in the right format. And the way they went about conducting the plebiscite, we now concluded and realized, was not adequate. In order for a plebiscite to be, I studied this, there were 114 ethno-plebiscites since World War II that established over 90 different new nations, okay? Most of them coming with the fall of the Berlin Wall in the 1990s. I've studied this. In order for a plebiscite to be effective, generally speaking, you have to get at least 80 to 85% of the population to participate.
Right.
We look at it with approximately 50 million African Americans. That's 29 million African Americans of voting age. And when I explained this to the Afro-descendant nation, that it was premature to launch a plebiscite ballot and vote when you had not done the groundwork, that was an error, and I couldn't support that. They felt that in 2024 that they had to do this for whatever reason. And so they, in their zeal, you know, with good intentions, launched that campaign and with those ballots, but it was inadequate preparation. It's going to take a massive education campaign to get 29 million people to leave work, leave school, go to 60 to 70,000 polling places throughout America and participate.
Let me say, I do agree. And I say that about reparations, and whether it's locally, state, or national, the groundwork that has to be done. And Elliot is a proponent of that, you know, and even here talking about, you know, what you could call it, Elliot, as far as having the community, you know, and community engagement.
Mm-hmm.
But although I think it's important, though, that the attempt to put something together, because as I see it and as I go through it, the beauty of it, and it can be used as a political educational tool towards that, because people are grounded in one of those four positions. But I think the ballot questions address, you know, maybe it may be more, but to my uninformed mind, it addressed each one of those four, right? Do you declare your right to receive full and complete reparations, self-determination, lawful identity, you know, all of these elements, do you consent to lawfully self-identify? Which of the four options would you prioritize as a pursuit, a form of
self-determination? It did hit all the areas as far as
This is, I'm glad you brought that up and you actually read some of that. So for people that this isn't their area of study or their work or their knowledge, you wouldn't understand that no plebiscite ballot in history looked like that or asked those kind of questions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A proper plebiscite on this will simply say, which of the four options do you want?
Okay.
That is it. So what Afro-descendant Nation did was they conducted a survey.
Mm-hmm.
A survey and a plebiscite are not the same thing, and they don't look the same way. A plebiscite for self-determination simply says, which of the four options do you want? And it lists the four options, and you mark that. That's it. I tried to persuade Afro-descendant to follow the historical patterns so that what we call a plebiscite is consistent with the international community's understanding and experience of it is. And so this is part of the problem. Since we don't have our independent New African international legal training on these things, we don't know if we're in alignment in conformity with such practices, right? So if we haven't been taught, we might hear the word plebiscite and think we know what that is, and then we construct a ballot that looks like this that really isn't that thing. So the intention is right, the sentiment is right, but the construction is wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, so... to me, the major obstacle is a proper education campaign that would lead to a successful plebiscite is going to require tens of millions of dollars for that education campaign.
Mm.
So who among us has those resources? It is what? The entertainment community, the sports stars, the actors and actresses, all of those people, right? If they don't come together and develop the political consciousness to where we're at with this, and then recognize that the only way to have an uncompromised plebiscite conducted under our own authority is through our own financing. We can't expect the United States ruling class or, you know, white folks in the United States to finance a new African plebiscite for self-determination. We have to do that. Maybe we can get some international funding, but you see what happened, for example, when Nation of Islam and Farrakhan succeeded in getting an agreement to get money from Libya. We saw what happened there.
Any help
that we get from the international community to do that is going to have geopolitical repercussions. So if we don't do it internally, and so this is where if we don't get everybody on board, and so those people that make a living through the sports, through the entertainment, stuff like that, we all know that if they get too political, too serious about our liberation, they get cut off. So who's going to be principled enough to make that sacrifice? This is what's holding us back. So the only other alternative is, how do you collect $1 from each person like Farrakhan showed us? How do we do that right now? Okay, we need $50 million to do a plebiscite education campaign, which is the first and major step in our liberation. We need $50 million. So instead of asking any small group of people to give big money, which they're not going to do, $1 from every black person in America. Can we do it? That's it. That simple.
I have no more questions. I appreciate the marching orders. I don't know.
let me take a couple of these calls, brothers, if you wait. Let's go to LaGrange, Georgia. Georgia?
Hey, greetings, gentlemen. How's everybody this evening?
Good.
All right. This has been a hard listen, but I appreciate it nonetheless. I had to drink a fifth up to now. I'm probably going to have to drink a half a gallon afterwards. But let me address a couple of, respond to a couple of things that I've heard. First of all, I just want to thank the guests for taking time to come and speak to us. I had a question about where he was from, but I think he addressed that. He said he repatriated, so I'm assuming that he probably once was, you know, a citizen in the United States, so we can correct me later on if that's not the case. A couple of things. I want to encourage people, anytime we're having these conversations, to kind of resist the temptation to paint United States or the West as, or Africa as, some type of panacea that's tantamount to the Christian heaven, because that's clearly not the case. White supremacy is global. Wherever you go, you're not going to escape white supremacy. Shout out to the Sahel states, Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, for trying to be an example that the other 51 nations can hopefully follow, because that conversation really needs to be in that pan. I've always said that Pan-Africanist conversation needs to be an African led and African started conversation without foundational black Americans. Because I mean, we got over here because of some of the machinations of Africans, along with the white supremacists who everybody's trying to tell us we need to separate from, which we know that we're separated from them, even living amongst them. So in that integration, that's just social, because, you know, we have to, you know, work at their places and all of those things. And another thing, as far as the this doom and gloom about we need to leave, we've been under pressure. That's what separates us. We fight, we don't flee. And of course, we really should. We really didn't supposed to get out of slavery, but somehow the Lord made a way. So, and that's another thing we need. We probably want to not generalize about what we don't hear in church. And I teach Sunday school, so I can guarantee you the church that I go to, we Dr. James Cone is one of our great liberation theologists, and this is Black History Month, and so we do want to respect the fact that this is Black history and this is our country. And another thing, we want to be respectful when we're talking to people, Black people here in America, people of the lineage, about telling them what's theirs and what's not, because see, everybody has their own unique lineage. You mentioned there was some mention of some red native tribes, but didn't hear no mention of the Lumbee, the Shinnecock, the Pomunkey, the Yamasee. Those people were here before the red natives arrived. The red natives are not indigenous to America. They came from Asia. They crossed the Bering Straits. And so, let's put some respect on that. And as far as the plebiscite, that was the last topic that was kind of being spoke about in depth. We use a term, and granted, we use it pejoratively. We call it plebiscite babble. The plebiscite is simply, you can cure the plebiscite just by simply what the speaker say he did. He decided to move and repatriate. And even in our reparations conversation, even though we push a lineage-based reparations, that is something that we understand that some people will probably do. And of course, if they get their largesse, or when they get their reparations, because it's going to happen, it may not even happen in our lifetime, but I believe in the ultimate universal righteousness, and it's going to happen. And they may, and salute to them. Now, I wouldn't go, but that's just my choice. But the plebiscite, you don't need to do all this elaborate sending ballots. Just get your money and go. A lot of people have. Some people have already went back and repatriated. And a lot of people have also came back with horror stories. So that's just the reality there. And this narrative about, 20% being in the minority. And I know some gentlemen that were with the Republic of New Africa. Matter of fact, I was on a Zoom call with a couple of them earlier today, and of course that was a real boss move. And of course, and we still have about 100 freedmen towns, towns created by freedmen in the United States. And here's on those numbers, see, when you frame everything by race, that's what the white people do, and that is a political strategy to make you always the minority. If we of course, reframe it, and this is how we can use political power, because we know that the white race is shrinking. Not only across. Just give me about two more minutes. I'll listen for about 35.
It don't matter. It don't matter.
Please, no.
I want you to hear this. This is my program, so you don't tell me. I just want you to that's cool. Let's go to Phoenix, Arizona. Phoenix.
Yeah, man. Get rid of that joker, cause he definitely have some mental problem.
I didn't get rid of him. He hung up. So
Yeah, well, let me excuse himself. That's good. That's appropriate. What Marcus Garvey say. Some of these people, they no use here. They ain't gonna be no use in Africa. They should stay there behind right here with the white man, okay? Because eventually he gonna get what's coming, He gonna get what's due. Cause the world is sick and tired of his foolishness. The world is sick and tired of him. You see, and white supremacy is on its way out, okay? You see the economy going. This brother here is right. The brother, your guess is correct, because this thing is collapsing. And we as black people got to figure out, what do we do? See, because we see it happening in real time in front of us. We see the economy is going down the drain. Donald Trump and his crew is trying everything, but it's like Humpty Dumpty. It's like Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall. So your brother is correct. We got to make some decisions on where, you know, what to do, how to move, because, and we got to move fast. We ain't got a lot of time. We ain't got a lot of time either, brother. So we better listen to what this brother said. The brother making a lot of sense, because it gonna come down. You see, the society is fracturing already. These, even the white people, they are gonna start fighting amongst themselves. Even on the airplane the other day in the midair, they're fighting. So the society is cracking. See, I don't know where, I don't know what he doing or what he see, but you know, he probably got some rose-colored glasses on, but the brother is on spot on. You see, you got to fight fire with fire, as the brother say, and don't let them dictate how we respond to their violence. See, they always come and say, oh, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. Hey, don't tell us how to respond to your violence that you put on us. And I close with this. Could it be the same people that's creating this chaos over there in the Middle East? Could it be the same people here that's keeping us looking here for salvation? Could it be those same people that keep us as a buffer between themselves and their white Anglo-Saxon brethren? I will close with that. Thank you.
Thank you for your contribution.
No problem, bro.
Brothers Freeway.
Yeah.
Listen, let me ask this in reference to some of the things Richard was bringing up, to kind of turn it back to what we were talking about. Out of the countries, out of the 54 countries, what, because you've been pushing for, DNA matters and things of that nature, what countries out of the 54 have accepted DNA to trace our lineage and decide to give out citizenship to those that are connected to those specific countries?
So the first and most progressive country that recognizes the Afro-descendant right of return is Benin, which in September of 2024 passed national legislation that says anyone with sub-Saharan African ancestry can obtain citizenship through their right of return. You don't even need a DNA test, but they will accept a DNA test to demonstrate your heritage. But it's not a requirement, which means they're not just saying we're going to give citizenship to anyone whose ancestry originated in Benin. It's any of us. And it's a real simple program. It takes 3 months and it costs $100. So if you don't, okay, when it comes to the issue of repatriation, I recommend that everybody take the African ancestry DNA test, the maternal and paternal test, which will identify specifically who you come from. And that is where your strongest right of return claim comes from. Because under the Geneva Convention, right, you have the right to be repatriated from where you were taken from. Until now, because of ethnocide and before the miracle of DNA testing, most of us could not say where in Africa we were taken from, which inhibited us making claims under international law under the Geneva Convention. Yeah, we know we come from somewhere in Africa, but where? Once you can identify and definitively say, I come from here, you automatically now have access to real rights of return. That through our own efforts, you have to, rights are things that you exercise. And at times, they're well-respected, and you don't have to fight for them, but other rights you do have to fight for. This is on us to make it, right, become normalized in this the next decade, right? The African Union says this is the decade of return. So within the next decade, there's supposed to be a massive voluntary migration. Now, beyond Benin, you have a handful of countries like Guinea-Bissau, like Sierra Leone, who have already set a precedent. Even if they don't have national legislation like Benin, they have a precedent, right, of accepting DNA lineage. So if you are an Afro-descendant of Temne or Mende or Lemba DNA, right, you can get your citizenship in Sierra Leone. If you're an Afro-descendant of Balanta, Fula, Jola DNA, you can get your citizenship in Guinea-Bissau. Ghana has its program, which just very recently attempted to require DNA testing and got such a backlash that they had to walk it back and suspend within a matter of days what they had launched. So those are the countries that are in the forefront. There are others that are doing things. But the thing that I want to emphasize is going back to this thing. We are not going to get everybody to agree that going back to Africa is the best thing, or integrating into America is the best thing, or fighting for a nation of your own like Republic of New Africa is the best thing. We're not going to get everybody to agree. Once you understand that, and you understand that as far back as the 1850s, when you had the fights between Delaney and Walker and then and Douglas.
Yes.
Okay. Historically, we have always fought over which one of these political destinies is the best. So let us accept that we're never going to conclude that once and for all for everyone. Everyone's going to have their different things. So even though I have repatriated, what I want is not for everyone to repatriate. As the caller said, Marcus Garvey said, there are some no good Negroes here and there'll be no good Negroes there and we don't want them, okay? We're not trying to force any one thing on anyone. What we're trying to do is go through the process where it can be registered within our nation of people. We have four factions, those that want to stay, those that want to leave, those that, right, we have four factions. So what if there's strength in number, you want to find out who are the people who want the same thing I want. So all the people that do want to repatriate, let's identify them and get them together, and then they can pursue what needs to be done to work with the 54 member states of the African Union to make that a reality. And they don't waste time with people who are not of like mind. Then you find out all the people that are nationalists and want to pursue building a self-determined nation of their own right there and there on land and territory that is not theirs, but they do have a claim to it. So you don't have to fight the integrationists or the repatriationists. You just need to know who is my group, and then we work to make that happen. And likewise, those that want to integrate. We need to stop fighting amongst ourselves about which one of these destinies is the best. There's no one right answer to that. For someone like me, it was easy to repatriate, but for the next person, it may be very difficult.
Difficult, yes, yes.
The plebiscite then sets us up for what? Getting the support, the allies, all the things that we are going to need in such a massive undertaking. Okay? Establishing a nation state like the Republic of New Africa is a massive undertaking that is going to need allies, international allies. Amari Obadeli taught us well the eight strategic areas of establishing a state. International relations was one of them, in diplomacy, which is why I got involved. So here it is. I've repatriated, but I actually served as Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Provisional Government of Republic of New Africa to say, look, I support that right to self-determination, just like I support the right to repatriate, just like I support the right. Guess what? Some people are going to stay and integrate into America. I want those people to be allies so that if we do set up a functioning, viable state like the Republic of New Africa, we have people in the American society and maybe even Black Congressional Caucus members who would to be our allies so that when we conduct foreign relations with the United States, we have people who have family in our camp and benefit us.
Yes.
So I'm not against the integrationists. It's a very sophisticated political analysis that Amari Obadeli gifted us with, and understanding the plebiscite concept. So we don't have to argue anymore. You don't have to explain or defend your choice. What we do is we fight for establishing the conditions that everybody gets the resources for the choice that they make. That's what a plebiscite does. But a plebiscite is not an easy thing to pull off.
Richard.
Yes, yes.
Brother Safiwe, I guess him being a diplomat, you can't put it no plainer.
No, I hear clearly. I hear clearly, and it's very and I appreciate the structural nature of it, and I keep using this, maybe just seeing the term, the real politics of it, because it just I think that we have left the first quarter of the 21st century.
It's, yep.
Just like those who left the first quarter of the 19th century. They were yep. real clear of the structure that they had to put in place in those conventions, the colored Negro conventions. That was that a process to do just what you're saying.
Yes,
we need to be doing now. It seems to me structurally,
Since you brought up those Negro conventions, let me say this: at that time when it was happening, what we now really understand is. Those Negro conventions were led by a specific class of people in our nation. Mm-hmm. They were generally educated Christians, right, that had been freedmen. And that class, in general, began to adopt the ideology that they had rights in America. For that class of people, becoming citizens and getting the right to vote was their tactic, their objective. But if you were a slave in that time, or you just came out of slavery, right, we know from research that the vast majority of people did not want to integrate and they didn't care about voting. What they wanted was land of their own and the ability to go and live separately amongst themselves. They were the nationalists.
Yes.
So by the time we had the Negro conventions, that class betrayed the self-determination plebiscite campaign that I'm kind of promoting, because in those Negro conventions, they didn't say you have four options. Which one do you want? They came. They were influenced by Frederick Douglass and the ideology that you had the right to vote and be treated as an equal citizen in the United States. That was a new kind of thinking for black folks who were just 5 minutes ago slaves and never even contemplated such a thing. It was only free black people had that kind of thinking. So we had to reevaluate those. This is why those Negro Congresses were not a plebiscite, and why what came out of that cannot be said to be the informed consent of our people. Because if they're only educated and encouraged to do one of the four choices, they're not properly informed.
I agree.
That we spend a lot of time reflecting on our history on this program, Rose Feeway, I guess, as you know. And that's why it's important now, especially in this environment that we're living in, that our people reach back and try to reinvent those times in history where we spoke to one another. And I'm talking about without involvement from other people. All this theories about, allies, European allies being involved. We need to talk to one another. So those men attempted it. You talked about Douglass and Garnett and others. They attempted to talk to one another and make decisions that was beneficial for the masses of our people. We can see that some of the decisions that some of the men made were wrong, just looking at history. But we need to talk to one another. You're absolutely right in the discussion that we had this evening. I can't agree with you more. Brother Sophie, let me ask you something, because you mentioned about the Africa DNA test, and that kind of narrows down the nations that you were from, or I don't like to use the word tribes, the nations that you were from, because I didn't take the African DNA. I took the other one, the ancestry. And that kind of narrowed down Togo and Benin and Nigeria. Is the overwhelming majority of my DNA is from those areas. So in the case like that, what would it take for me to get citizenship in Benin, or I don't know, or even Togo?
Well, in Benin, you very easily, it's self-evident, have African lineage. You just go to the Benin website, you start the process, get the application, fill it out, pay your $100, and 3 months later, right, you go through the process, you become a citizen of Benin. It is the easiest, most streamlined, most respectful to our condition, because the fact of the matter is this. Since the first arrival of our ancestors, right, in what is now the United States of America, we simultaneously went through a process of ethnocide, which is the destruction of your ethnic identity, and we went through the process of ethnogenesis, the creation of new ethnicities. We went through that simultaneously. So those of us who don't know our maternal or paternal ancestry and those lineages, it's not your fault. And they can't, properly speaking, justice should not require you to provide something that through a crime you're unable to provide. That is not justice. Okay? So on that hand, I am not someone that says that DNA testing should be a requirement for getting citizenship. So Benin is the only place right now, right, where you can go and do that fairly easily. But what I do want our audience to know is that reparations, in terms of it meaning repair, healing, repairing the damage of ethnocide is you don't know your maternal ancestral lineage or your paternal ancestral lineage. And so if we're seeking to repair that, the African ancestry DNA test is the only test that identifies your non-recombinant DNA. That is the DNA that's passed directly from father to son to son to son to son to son. It never changes. Or from mothers to daughters to daughters to daughters to daughters to daughters, and it never changes. And so African Ancestry, which is a company founded by our own people, Dr. Kittles and Gina Page, have their own technology, their own databases, right, is the only test that will tell you who you come from, your maternal or paternal line. Now, you have other DNA that gets mixed in with your maternal and paternal line, like decorations on a Christmas tree, right? Sorry that I have to use that, because we already talked about not celebrating those holidays, but this is the best picture I can draw for right now, so I beg your forgiveness. But if you look at a Christmas tree, that evergreen tree, its ancestral lineage is it's an evergreen tree. But every year you get a new ornament, or every generation someone marries into your root maternal or paternal lineage and contributes a little bit of DNA that hangs like a decoration on your maternal or paternal ancestry. That's what those other DNA tests measure. How much of the decorations on your tree come from this country or this region or that region. But it doesn't tell you where the tree came from. That's what you want to know. Where did my tree come from? So I recommend, whatever your four choices, whether you want to repatriate to Africa, stay in America National, whatever it is, everybody should want to restore their ancestral lineage.
Who they are.
And by the miracle of DNA testing, we can do it now. That is one of the gifts, as Richard keeps reminding us, we've just passed the first quarter of the century. This technology was introduced to us in the first quarter. It didn't exist in 1999.
Yes.
Okay. It exists now. It came about in 2003. So Richard is spot on in saying, guess what? We were given a new technology, a new tool to help us in our ongoing quest for liberation and freedom. And a million of us have used that tool. I am Balanta descent on my paternal side and Yoruba on my maternal side. A million people have taken that test. And each one of those millions of people is related to 10 other people who that result is good for. So technically, right now, in the beginning of this first quarter of this century, 10 million people, right, have now started that process of recovery from ethnocide by at least identifying their maternal or paternal ancestry.
Mm.
That is very, very
powerful.
Yeah, very powerful.
Yeah.
Listen, before we go, let's take this last call. Orlando?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm in the process now of applying for the Benin citizenship. I have filled out the application. Now I just got to list my documents. And I asked a question to them because my son took his DNA and my nephew took my African ancestry DNA. My son used 23andMe. And I asked them if I could use their DNA, but they recommended to me, this was through the chat, is that my mother's birth certificate, my father's birth certificate, I got to have a criminal records. So I'm in the process of uploading those documents now in order to try to get my citizenship. And as far as me now, it was a very simple process. And it's My Afro Origins. If you go to My Afro Origins, then it'll take you there to the application. I just wanted to throw that in. I'll hang up, listen to you.
Hold on 1 second. Brother Safiway?
Yes.
Any comment for the brother before he hangs up?
Just to congratulate him. It's profound to get to that point where you are welcomed by being a citizen. So I'm just congratulations. I hope the process continues to be smooth. And 3 months from now, you can call back into the show and say, I got it, and be an example and a leader, not just for your family, but for all the community. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. And last thing before I go, I've been trying to get information on the coup in Guinea-Bissau. And is that a good coup or a bad coup? Do you have any information that you can relay before I go?
Yes, it is a bad coup. And okay. I have just published an article online entitled Understanding the Situation in Guinea-Bissau After the November 2025 election ceremonial coup. This is your one-stop resource for understanding exactly what happened. And I am not only an eyewitness, right? I'm like here witnessing it. I'm involved with some of the major players in all of this. And if you go to balanta.org and you click on the news tab, you will see the article entitled Understanding the Situation in Guinea-Bissau After the November 2025 Election Ceremonial Coup. or you can type in understanding the situation in Guinea-Bissau and Balanta in Google, and you'll get there. So there's a resource for the listeners to be able to read and really follow how this situation came to be. But the bottom line is, these are enemies of the people. The people had an election. They voted. They said, this is what we want, right? And these people had guns and took over, and they faked a coup. They detained the former president and then helped him get on a plane and escape and are preparing for his return. And the transition leaders are all friends and relatives of the former president that was defeated in the elections. He is just simply trying to retain power rather than hand it over to his political opposition. So it's a bad coup, full stop.
Okay. And Balanta is spelled B-A-L-A-N-T-A?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank y'all for taking my call.
Hey, brother, before you go, you said your son took the African DNA?
My nephew took the my African DNA because it goes through your mother and her mother and her mother. And his mother is my sister. And we are from Mali, which is the Tuareg. My mother on my mother's side, she's from Mali on the Tuareg tribe, of the Tuareg tribe.
Oh, okay. All right. Hey,
yeah.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Brother Sahiwe, interesting conversation tonight, man. I'm glad to have you back with us. And, you know, listen, the door is open anytime you want to give updates or things of that nature. I'll be in touch with you, you know, back and forth. So if anything arises, we can, I'll reach out to you. And plus, I got the information from you for the African DNA. I want to bring the sister. Is it her husband or just a brother that works with her?
So you're referring to Gina Page.
Yes.
And yeah, it's her colleague, Dr. Kittles.
Okay. Yeah. I want to reach out to, you know, bring them on so they can explain to the listening audience the whole process and, you know, how and why they got started, things of that nature. So yeah, I want to thank you for that.
I'll send you a link to her presentation at the Ninth Pack. She gave an incredible 9-minute presentation that is a great introduction to the significance of what they do. I'll send you that link. It's worth sharing with all the listeners.
Okay. Where did she do the presentation? Or it's just a presentation on what they did? She do it at one of the forums? Or
no, she did it a keynote address in Lomé.
Okay.
At the main plenary session. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Okay. I'll mm-hmm. be looking forward to it. And thanks for your contribution to the program. Before you go, is there any... in fact, you gave out the link, but give out the links where people can read some of the publications, some of your work, anything you want to give us social media-wise, the floor is yours.
Yeah, so a lot of that information is on our website. It's balanta.org, B-A-L-A-N-T-A, balanta.org. If you go there, you can explore the site, especially the news tab or the history tab. We'll give you, you know, I'm constant every month. We're updating content with reports on what's happening in these different forums and other things. So that's the best way to kind of get good information that is a good resource for your research and your understanding. Again, platforms like, you know, Time for an Awakening is where I'm able to take that research and talk about it. So I'm really grateful that we have these independent platforms with, you know, yourself, Elliot, and Richard, who understanding these issues and being able to bring it to the masses of our people and listeners so that they can know what's going on from our own self-determined point of view.
Thanks for your contribution, sir. I'll be in touch.
All right.
You have a good one.
All right.
All right. Thank you, Richard.
Peace.
You know. Peace.
Richard.
Yes.
Excellent conversation tonight. I really enjoyed having Brother Sahiwe come back and give us an update on what happened at the Pan-African Congress.
very real. I think, you know, the information is, it gives us a realistic view of what is and the work we have to do. Hopefully we'll be reevaluating the work we're doing in order to make, to line up with, you know, real on the ground intel of what, you know, what exists. And those four choices in the plebiscite, like, you can't get no clearer than that. Simple and clear, but the complexity is in the organizing.
Okay. All right. Richard, before we leave tonight, I want to read this shit. This it came out in the BBC, and it's probably in the American media. In fact, I know it is in American media also, but I saw it on BBC. And it's something that we, you know, it's sad for me to see, because I knew this was going to happen, but we got to do something as a people to push back against this foolishness. Let me read this here. Troop becomes an African-American, becomes first African-American killed in drug boat targeting operations. A U.S. Marine who fell overboard from an attack ship in the Caribbean has become the first known American casualty in Trump administration's operation targeting drug trafficking boats. Lance Corporal Chumique Aforo, 21, fell from the U.S. Iwo Jima on February 7th and was lost at sea. He was pronounced dead after a lengthy search, which ended on February 10th. His death was announced on Wednesday and remains under investigation by the military. The Florida native was assisting Operation Southern Spear, which carried out 38 lethal strikes on alleged drug boats in the Caribbean and Pacific Ocean since September. It played a key role in the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. A statement from the U.S. Marines contained no details regarding how he had fallen from the ship. Families of two Trinidad men killed in the operation in October the 14th strike have filed a lawsuit against the American government, alleging the strike amounted to lawless killings in cold blood, killings for sport, and killings for theater. So I just wanted to read that. This is a young black boy, 21 years old, Richard.
Yeah.
He falls off the ship. He's the only one that fell. No details on how he fell or anything like that. And the incident is under investigation.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't want my sons and daughters and doing anything for this imperialist aggression that's going on all over this world.
I understand that.
I just wanted to share that before we go, man. Before we go, let me give the lineup on time for the Awakening Media. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Always interesting topics, dialogue, and guests on African Perspectives. It's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Later on Monday evenings, Our Story with Baba West Johnson from New Orleans, Louisiana, from 7 to 9 p.m. on Mondays, and they double back on Wednesdays at the same time, 7 to 9 p.m., with Baba West Johnson and host Brother Johnny on Our Story. That's Mondays and Wednesday evenings. Thursdays always open for the Black Liberation Movement in Mississippi from 8 to 10 p.m. Brother Patrick Lumumba, Sister Crystal Denise, Brother Rodney Lowe, Brother Malik Hayes, four hosts, one mission, the Black Liberation Movement in Mississippi. That's Thursdays from 8 to 10. On Sundays, Pinckney to Pinckney from 5 to 6, and Time for the Awakening from 6 until. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion as always, and we'll be back next week, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
Your children playing after school.
children. Soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of the things that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. She got to teach school. If we know, all we say we know about the problems. Oh. Why can't we do something to try and solve it?
To save the children.